Monday, December 11th, for the review session for HDFS 5. And look, I'm remembering to record it. Having failed on Friday, for which I apologize to those people who were hoping I might have recorded my words of wisdom for posterity. How are you all? Stressed? Tired? You want to... Okay. I was trying to count the number of people over the last 3 or 4 days have said, oh, classes are over, now you can relax, right? No. That's not what faculty do for the next 10 days. But... You want the advice first? Get a good night's sleep tonight. Eat breakfast. Have a little snack before the exam, because it starts at 12:15. Go to the right room. Take a number 2 pencil. Take a snack with you. Bring a snack. But not rustly paper or something that crunches. Okay. What do you need to know? I'm sorry? Attachment. Can we go over attachment? Can we become over attached?
Or
how parenting style relates to attachment? Okay. Parenting and attachment type. Okay. Was that in the sample questions on the website? Is that where you pulled that one out of? Okay. Okay, it's a big question, it's a whole series of questions, so let's put them all together and see if we can tease out what you would need to be thinking about depending on which part of the question you were addressing, which would depend on which one we might ask. Okay, so when you think about attachment, we're typically thinking about infants, right, and toddlers. And we started that section by talking about the physical characteristics of the infant, the newborn, that lay the foundation for social relationships. Remember the sensory tuning, the behaviors that newborns tend to engage in that adults respond to. So you ought to be able to talk about what newborns and infants do that promote attachment, and who are they trying to get attached to? That's parents or caregivers. And we as adults taking care of infants also try to do things. We respond to infants. We initiate behavior with them. So it would be helpful if you can understand and describe what adults do, what caregivers do when we're taking care of infants and toddlers. And that leads to a set of transactions between infants and caregivers that lead to attachment. Okay. So those transactions lead to attachment, and attachment comes in different styles. Okay. So there are a variety of characteristics of those relationships, and you ought to be able to describe, I hope you can describe, or at least label the major types and have some understanding of what those look like. So you have secure attachment. What are the others? Avoidant. Okay. When you respond, there's a noise up here that just wipes out whatever you say. Secure, avoidant,
ambivalent,
disorganized. Is that separate from ambivalent? Yes. And anxious? I don't know, are they? Yes, clearly. Avoidant is the resistant. I'm going to stay away from you. I don't want to be close to you. And the anxious is the clingy. I can't let you be away from me. I don't know what I'm... I don't know whether I trust you or not. So, yeah, anxious and avoidant are clearly distinct types. I'm sorry? Well, there probably were, but somebody threw out another one, and so that's probably something we need to check in the book before we finalize a question about it. Secure, avoidant, ambivalent, and disorganized. Okay. Those two might go together. I'll accept whatever the text says. Wait. Co-regulation is part of, assuming we're talking about it in the caregiver-child relationship, there are other places, but I assume you wanted it in here, that there are certain of these transactions that sometimes get described as co-regulation. It simply means that the parent and the child are affecting each other, the caregiver and the child are affecting each other, and they are regulating each other's behavior so that the infant has its own characteristics, the caregiver has his or her characteristics, and when they come together, they create a transaction that has specific characteristics based on those characteristics that each bring. But in the process of trying to create a relationship, they modify each other's responses. So, yeah, it's another way of describing the fact that there is a transaction building, and that both the parent or the caregiver and the infant are affecting each other, and what they're trying to do is create a consistent and comfortable way of transacting with each other. So when when something unusual happens in the environment, the infant looks to the caregiver to see how the caregiver is going to respond to this, to see how she ought to respond, how the infant ought to respond. So kids look to their parents. Am I supposed to be afraid? Am I supposed to be happy? What am I supposed to do with this thing that I don't have any idea of what is? It just happened. One of the classic video examples of that is kid and caregiver together, and suddenly the experimenter puts on loud Mozart in the laboratory, and the kid goes like that and looks at the caregiver, and if the caregiver begins to look anxious and upset by this, then the infant gets upset. if the caregiver says, oh, isn't that neat? Isn't that fun? Let's dance. Then the kid says, oh, okay, this is fun. Let's dance. So they're taking their cues from each other. On the other side of a transaction like that, put the chalk down. Don't put the chalk near your mouth. Because your throat doesn't like it. So what happens is on the other side of that transaction is something will happen, and the caregiver will carefully study the infant or the toddler, the child, to see what the child's reaction is going to be to figure out what I need to do next. Two examples from the dinner I went to last night with a two-year-old. I don't know what he did, but I heard that distinctive sound of a two-year-old's head on a hardwood floor. It's a very distinctive sound. Once you hear it, So I immediately tuned into the two-year-old. I watched his father tune into the two-year-old, and so there he is, and we're both waiting to see what our response should be. I'm ready to go for 911. The father's ready to pick the kid up. He's looking. The kid's going. And then the kid looks at the father. So we're doing this. I don't know how to respond to this. I don't know whether I hurt myself until I see whether you're upset. That's the kid's response. So the kid decides, since dad is just looking, that he must not have hurt himself, shakes his head, gets up, and goes on about his business. And because he shakes his head, dad then relaxes. So dad knows, okay, I don't have to call 911, I don't have to do anything. So the father's emotional response and his action in response to the child's behavior is based on what the kid is doing. And in a similar situation at a different time, same kid, same father, I watched the kid. He's really quite coordinated and quite adroit, but I watched him run into a wall. We all do that occasionally, you know, even I. And he did hurt himself. And he clearly hurt himself. He creased his face. And, left a dent, but not permanent. He didn't crack anything, and he didn't actually break the skin. He just hit the corner of the wall real hard. And he really did hurt himself, and he immediately started to wail, so you know he was hurt. And dad picked him up immediately and started to soothe him. So the father's response in each case is regulated according to what the child's response is. And the child is regulating his response to other things by what the parents are doing. And that's a process that we all go through constantly. And it has various other terms that are used for it. Sometimes, not sure whether this text talks about social referencing, which is exactly the same thing. Something happens, the kid looks to the adult, the teacher, the caregiver, big brother, big sister, to see, okay, how am I supposed to respond to this? And it's a very important concept when you're raising children or teaching children, because what we sometimes see is that parents overreact, they react too quickly, the parent, him or herself, is anxious and insecure and responds in a way that tells the kid, okay, you should be upset, you should be anxious, you're obviously hurt, you should be afraid, and you have that transaction often enough and you have a fearful child. But if you let the kid bounce off the wall and wait and don't immediately run to the kid's aid and assume that the child is injured for life, if you just step back a bit and see how the child responds, you create a child whose tendency is to, okay, I'll shake that one off. Yeah. I wasn't really hurt, so I'm not going to overreact to it. And then you've got a kid who's not always whining and crying every time he or she bumps his nose. So it's an important concept because it says that the parent's response is going to help shape how the child responds emotionally to stimuli. And you're going to create, you bring that back to attachment, you're going to create security by the way you transact with the child. You're going to create anxiety. You're going to create resistance on the part of the child. So it's the nature of the transactions that the parent is engaging in, which are also being driven in part by the child's tendencies. And some kids overreact, some kids react very strongly, some kids, you know, never know that they're hurt because they don't pay any attention. You had a follow-up. No, not yet, but hang on to that question because we're only started on this one. Okay? So as you look at the attachment characteristics that the child is taking forward into life, that style is likely to characterize other relationships that the child is engaging in. As you develop friendships, and later I think the specific question was about partnering, as you start to date, the assumption is that what you've learned in infancy and childhood is going to at least be the initial framework for how you create other kinds of attachments. So there are other attachments. And there's going to be some continuity between those, the way your parents have created your attachment style and what you carry into other relationships. Now those will also then result, the specifics of those partnering relationships will result from the characteristics that the new partner in the dance is bringing to the floor. So the person you're trying to partner with may be quite different from your parents, and then you've got to sort that out. But your initial assumption about attachments is going to be based on the infant and toddler experience that you've had. Carrying that one, I think part of that question was about your own parenting behavior. What's the parent doing in regard to attachment? You've partnered, now you're parenting. What do you sort of need to have if you're going to be parenting? This is not a trick question. What makes you a parent? A child. Okay, thank you. So you've carried it to the next generation. You have an infant who's going to bring his or her characteristics into a new attachment situation in which you are the parent and there's a new player now, the next generation. And it's going to start over again. Okay. But the constructivist's assumption is that the way you were parented led to a style of attachment for you. Now you're on the other side of that transaction. And you're likely at least to start that transaction with the same kind of style. Unless something has happened to change you, to give you a different repertoire of behaviors, you're now carrying that into this new transaction. And our best hypothesis about what you're going to do comes from looking at what was done to you. How did you develop that attachment when you were an infant? Now you're the parent, you're on the other side of it. But it'll be a little different probably because the infant may be a little different. Okay. So if you tackle that very large question, you would want to talk about the potential for continuity as you take your attachment style into different kinds of relationships, and particularly to look at what happens then when you're on the other side of the mother-infant or parent-infant transaction. There was a piece in there about parenting style, and the parenting style material in the text is, okay, parents do things differently, they have different expectations. That's a way of talking about what they're putting into the transaction. It's affecting attachment. Okay. People who use different styles create different kinds of attachments. It's being carried on as the child continues to develop. So if you look at what's happening to the child in adolescence, as the parent applies that style. The style is a way of engaging in transactions. What are you expecting? How are you responding to your child and adolescent? So it, again, it may be continuous, but it's likely to change a bit as kids develop new attitudes, problems, potentials, risks. And they're changing that transaction constantly too. So it's another way of thinking about what the parents are doing. I would probably not ask all of that in one multiple choice question. I can't imagine. Would you write one? No, that's above. Next year, would you write one that encompasses all of that? You might very well see part of that in an essay question. Yeah. I don't know that I would ask the whole thing. And if I did, you'd have to do some picking and choosing. But the important part would be to make sure that you were addressing each of the elements in it, and you were thinking about the different kinds of transactions, the parent-child transaction in infancy, partnering transactions, the parent-child transaction when you're the adult. And then, you know, very importantly for this course, think about why it is we would expect any kind of connection between what happened to you as an infant and what you're going to do as a parent. How do you explain that? Thank you. Good question. Totally unrelated. Okay.
What's the sort of numerical breakdown of like multiple choice versus essays? Is that going to be 110 points exam?
This one would be worth potentially 110 points because there are, as of this moment, 3 essay questions, each worth 10. 3 out of 4, as always. And there are currently exactly 80 multiple choice questions worth 1 point each. After I proofread the exam, I may occasionally I'll put an exam together and discover that I've asked the same question twice. And then there's this moment of, okay, do I just have 79 or do I ask Talia to write another one to fill in? Yeah, but right now it's 80 multiple choice. Neo-Piagetian what?
Stages?
Of what?
Yeah, in the book,
it's
like random.
Yeah, kind of random. Let me make something up. I'm a constructivist, right? That means I get to make things up. There is discussion in the book about Neo-Piagetian approaches to cognitive development. Neo-Piagetian means what? Means they came after Piaget. And they are in some way built on or responsive to Piaget. But they typically are people who have some beef with Piaget and want to make it better. So they call themselves Neo-Piagetian. We respect him, but we respectfully disagree. And so we create some kind of new stages, and I don't know what the text is referring to there. I'd have to go back and look. The question is, would I go over differentiation and integration in all three domains? Sure. Because it's the same in all three domains. The process, right, you should be able to recite it by now. The process of differentiation is changing your understanding of something or it changing itself from an undifferentiated or global simple state to a state where parts are separated or they become different from each other. The simple definition of differentiation. And then the integration part is that developmentally, mostly what's happening is that we're making things distinct or we're differentiating them so that we can put them back together into a more complex whole. So when there's a question about differentiation and integration, you want to start with the state of being undifferentiated and figure out what gets distinguished here. How do parts get separated? How do they become different from each other? And then once they get different from each other, how does that make things more complex? And my thesis is that that's constant all the way through all kinds of development. And if you keep that general principle in mind as you're trying to understand how something happens, how something develops, it'll give you some leverage in understanding what it is that I need to understand, what is it I need to pay attention to as I watch something get more complex. So biologically it might be the example we've used over and over again is the arm buds, which are not differentiated. It's just a lump of tissue growing out from the torso until the cells start to become different from each other, and then instead of just tissue, we have a couple of things going on. We have cartilage being built up as we begin to create a bone in the middle of this lump, and then as the lump enlarges, it becomes segmented, so we have two parts to the arm, and the end of it creates the beginnings of a hand. So it has more parts, so that's the differentiation. It went from being just a lump to having parts, and then those parts are being put together to create a limb with all of its major parts. Cognitively, that process happens every time we make our language more precise, or we put schemas together. We differentiate out of our experience parts of the experience and understand that they are different from each other as we become able to detect the differences. So we see that schemas are now different, and then we integrate those schemas and put them together to create a more complex understanding. In the psychosocial realm, we do that with our emotions. So we sort out various ways that we respond emotionally. Bowen's theory involves differentiation and integration, because he's talking about differentiation of thinking from feeling, and then putting those back together so that we can think about our feelings, and I guess feel about our thinking, and think while we're feeling, so that those processes become more more complex. Another example I gave in the psychosocial realm was from Sullivan, whose basic tenet is that we start with a caregiver relationship and essentially treat everybody the same. If you've watched infants, you can pass them around the room and they're happy as long as somebody's holding them and feeds them if they're hungry. They don't differentiate people very well. So they treat the whole world as one, and then gradually they distinguish one person, and then we develop a repertoire of ways of behaving toward different kinds of people. So we develop a variety of relationships, and we don't treat our big sister the way we treat our mother. We separate those people and we treat them differently, and we understand that they are different. And we treat our best buddy differently than we do our big sister. We have different kinds of games. We have different language. So you're differentiating all different kinds of people, but you're able to integrate those into, in one sense, a personality, but in the more direct sense, you're taking those different relationships and being able to move among them and move from one relationship to another over time. To talk on the phone with your best buddy while you're talking to your mother over here, and keep those two conversations separate, but do them at the same time. Or go to a dinner party with six or eight different kinds of people from four different generations. The one I went to last night had people from, they were all related to each other, except one. It's one family. So three generations. Four countries of origin. Five. Seven languages. Eight counting English. Nine counting two-year-old. But the two-year-old speaks several languages. And it was a very interesting act of integration to be able to eat and talk and keep everybody's stories and who they were separate. Yeah. Enough? Yeah, you will be forever. But it'll get better. Being able to integrate them well enough that you can, in a conversation, fill in the gaps and explain to the woman from Puerto Rico what the person from India is talking about in the middle of the story, and do that in a way that allows her to pick up on where he was in the story and then elaborate it herself. So you're integrating all these different communication needs and communication styles and what everybody is doing, and being aware of the fact that she missed that part of the story because she was checking on the salad. And I don't want to stretch that example too far. What I recommend that you do in thinking about the psychosocial domain particularly is come up with examples from your own experience and work on trying to describe those. How does psychosocial development
affect physical development?
What did you learn from your friends in adolescence? Smoking, drinking. As your peer group expands, one there are many ways to answer that question, but as your peer group expands and you're involved, particularly in adolescence, in more situations with a wider variety of peers from different backgrounds, and have less adult supervision, which is one of the characteristics of the adolescent stage, it's a psychosocial change, you're more with peers, less with adults as you go through adolescence. That may affect your biological development by exposing you to all kinds of things that your parents might have wished that you hadn't gotten exposed to. That's one simple way. Another is that there's a strong connection between having friends as you get older and your biological health. One of the predictors of a healthy, relatively long old age is whether or not you're sociable, is whether you have friends and actively involved in friendships when you're a young adult. And the text describes that connection between your sociability in young adulthood and the long-term health and how long you live. So friends affect your biological state. And there's a chicken and egg problem in that transaction, because it may be that people who aren't very healthy are less sociable, particularly as they get older. So it's hard to sort out. But the prediction is pretty good from sociability in early adulthood and a healthy old age. There are a couple of others that's connected. People who have close intimate friendships, not just sociability, but intimate friendships in early and middle adulthood, tend to live longer and happier and healthier. If marriage is a psychosocial characteristic, being married, there's a connection between being married and how long you live and how healthy you are in old age. Of course, the happiest, you know who's the happiest in old age? People who never married. I think. Check that one out in the text. Right, but boy, are they happy. I know, they're all priests and nuns, right? No, I made that up. Don't take that away. I was just thinking of which people are not likely to get married. Only 2%. I'd take that with a grain of salt. How many of us are gay and not permitted to marry in most jurisdictions? How many of us are celibate? Add those two together, remove some for overlap, and you're probably up fairly close to your 2% or higher.
Well, so,
right, yeah. Why does the book say that? I don't either. Okay. Different question.
With Sternberg, you gave us like three different things to go with.
Three components of love.
Yep. But you drew out three different versions of it. I was wondering what you wanted us to really understand about Strindberg and what... Because you had added a fourth element in class, the comparability.
Right. Well, obviously, that's the one you should remember. If I add it, no. I'm sorry, I'm a little flaky. I gave you the three components from Strindberg, which is from the text. And I used another overhead that combined those in various combinations with the consummate love, combining all three. Was that also in the text, or did I rip that off from someplace else? Not in the text? Oh. Okay, well, what's in the text is what's important. Did you make a note to... have me make a note in the text about adding that. Okay, got it. And think about the notion of compatibility, which is not necessary for love, but certainly is for staying together a long time. Yes. Epigenetic principle? Okay. Erikson's epigenetic principle is, if I can paraphrase it, that anything that grows, is anything that is alive and more complex than a one-celled organism, has parts. If you're a complex organism, you have parts. And because of the way biology works, growth involves those parts emerging in a sequence at different times. And he asserts that generally, and he's borrowing from embryology. A seed, as it germinates, develops in a particular way, and there's a particular sequence and time. And he's simply borrowing that concept and saying the same thing happens for people psychologically. Now, Freud had said that, but he hadn't given it that label. So Erikson is trying to convince us that the sorts of issues that arise as we go through the lifespan are built into us in the same way that embryologic development is built into us, or puberty, or menopause, or aging. Those are all built into the biological organism, and he's asserting that same principle applies to psychological development. And is then represented by the eight stages that he describes. And any stage theorist that connects the stages to age or says there's a particular sequence that's connected in any way to physical growth will essentially be saying the same thing. There's a built-in order, a sequence of changes. So any normative stage theory is going to reflect that. And then what he does with it is say that the issues that are involved are the result of the individual developing biologically so that particular tasks or challenges or potentials are present, and we grow up in social settings, contexts, families, societies, communities, that are also responding to those same potentials and challenges and characteristics. And they are either helping us deal with them, or they're reflecting them in some way, or they're putting us through particular kinds of trials or tests or challenges or making problems for us as we go through those biological changes. And that combination of the internal changes that are built into us and the external expectations and demands create the psychosocial tasks and challenges that he describes. It's very elegant. It's very compelling in many ways, because it gives us a framework for looking at what's important about the family at this particular time in a child's life or in a person's life, or what are the tasks that are likely to be facing me as I become old. You become old just because you live long enough, and aging is built into the body. And I live in a society and with people who respond to my aging in particular ways. And either they're resisting it. It's kind of fun. My kids are, to use the personal, literally the personal example of aging, is that my kids don't see me often enough to keep up with how I'm aging. So was interesting. It's been interesting over the last couple of years to have them confront the fact that I don't do some of the things I used to do. I don't do them in the same way. And for me, it's just, you know, you adapt and you go along. But they still think of me as 45, I think. And of course, I still think of them as 22, so it's mutual, reciprocal. But they're faced with adjusting their expectations for me. And yeah, that's enough there. Be familiar with them. It probably would be a good idea to know when each occurs, and yeah. We talked in the review session Friday about whether there was some easy mnemonic device, and we don't have one. It's not like King George. I didn't learn that one. I learned Connie Karen's old-fashioned gathered skirt in biology. I didn't learn the King George version. Lisa.
People, Sullivan, Salmon, Erickson, Kagan, Douglas, Montefiore, Berger, am I missing? I've heard people that kind of stand up that are repeated constantly. Those are the ones that I...
Bowen, Kagan, Erickson, Sullivan, Sternberg, Valent, Levinson, Helson, Gilligan. I haven't proofread it yet. The question was, are they all going to be relevant to the exam? No, but they're all relevant to understanding human development. If they're important in the text, they're potentially on the exam. So if Levinson gets talked about four or five times in different chapters in the text, if that's the case, I'll write a couple of questions. I'm sorry, which question?
There was an active question about connecting the three domains.
Right. Okay. If there were a question about how the three domains are interconnected, I would probably ask you to pick one time in the lifespan. and then that's open to you. I would not say in 125 words or less, review the whole course, integrating all three domains from conception to recycling. Great doctoral exam question. But no, I would ask you, give us an example, explain it, talk about all three domains and how they're interrelated with each other. I might, in a question like that, I might say, pick one of the following three or four. I might just say, pick one, whatever you're interested in.
Can you do that? Could you go relate all the three chunks with puberty?
Can you do all three chunks with puberty? Sure.
Can we go over that?
Oh, can I go over it right now in case you wanted, in case there were a question like that and you wanted to talk about puberty? Huh. Puberty is a good example because everybody's relatively familiar with it. Parts of it. Yeah. Okay, so you're going to pick puberty, and you want to talk about the biological domain, and you want to talk about the cognitive domain, and you want to talk about the psychosocial domain, and how they're related to each other. So ideally, what you would do is think about how does each of these change at puberty or during that period of time? So clearly biology is in fact the defining characteristic for puberty. You know that about the same time formal operational thinking begins to appear, but you also know that we're not very clear about the connection between those two. We assume it's there, Piaget assumed it's there, but there's not very good data about how the brain changes are related to the cognitive changes. But there are other ways to tackle that part of it. And then you all know that your friendships and your family relationships and your significant others change as you go through puberty because. And Sullivan says, because now you have this new need for sexual gratification. So you start looking at each other in different ways than you did as children. So in answering that question, what you want to do is to think about how the biological and cognitive are connected to each other and how the biological and the psychosocial are connected to each other and how the cognitive and the psychosocial are connected to each other. And theoretically, where you want to go is to think about transactions in both directions. Now, that's easier done, more easily done in some examples than in others. Sometimes it's not possible to say, well, this one affects that one in this direction. And it's okay just to say that. I don't have a clue how it might go in that direction. But in the other direction, it's clear that. Yeah. So in this case, because you go through puberty, you hear what my daughter called the term the call of the gonads, and that affects your friendships, it affects your social life, because responding to the call of the gonads is likely to change the way you think about the kids that you've known. Other people are going to respond to your biology by changing their expectations of you. So as you become mature, they're going to change their expectations. Truck drivers are going to whistle at you if you're female. People are going to look at you differently. They're going to respond to you differently. Your father's going to be uncomfortable with a full frontal hug, and you are too, so that relationship is going to change. It's temporary. People get really... Pubescents are very self-conscious, and it's very important to let them have space and let them close the bathroom door and not to make jokes about their bodies. It's very important. But it's also... And don't hug them too much, especially in public. They don't like that. But it's temporary. It's okay. After 3 or 4 years, they get over it, and then you can go back to an affectionate... We hug everybody. Everybody gets kissed. Relationship. It's important that it's a temporary thing. So where are we? Everybody's looking at your biology differently. You're trying to figure out what's changed. They're treating you differently. So one of the ways that your cognitive skills are challenged is that now you're trying to figure out what is wrong with these people. Your parents are behaving differently. They're becoming more restrictive if you're female. They're trying to keep you from getting harmed. And you're trying to deal with that. You don't want them to restrict you. You don't want them to narrow your opportunities. In fact, you would prefer that they went the other way. So you have a cognitive challenge. You're also challenged to figure out what's going on biologically and what does this mean? If I'm going to go through puberty and I'm going to have the potential to reproduce and they tell me I'm a woman now, what does that mean? And especially if they tell me I'm a woman now, I mean, this is a big intellectual challenge because I'm not, you know, I know I'm not. But if you are female, then what does that mean? And maybe that drive some of the intellectual change that happens cognitively. But it certainly provides you a cognitive challenge. The cognitive changes, if formal operational changes are connected, well, they're happening anyway, so they're happening about the same time, they're going to increase conflict with the parental units. And you're going to argue with them differently. So as they change the way they deal with you, you're going to change the way you deal with them. So the text says that adolescents and parents argue more as kids enter adolescence. And one of the reasons for that is that parents don't know how to deal with adolescence in the first place. You're becoming an adolescent reminds them that they were adolescents and they don't want you to be like them, so they're going to change the way they behave toward you. It also reminds them that they're getting old, so they're going to get a little touchy around you, and that's going to cause more conflict. And adolescents exercise their intellectual skills by arguing with their parents. It's safer to argue with parents than teachers and other people. There they are, and it's important to argue with them. Okay. So whatever event you choose, try to think about it in every possible direction and at least provide some description of how they might be connected to each other. And I think, you know, on the website there's that whole list of events and transitions, and they're all fair game. I think in each case there's at least the beginning of a discussion of what changes are taking place in each domain. What I didn't do was fill in the relationships among the domains. So if you want to look over those, you get some more ideas.
How does the cognitive situation affect your temperament and biological
aspects? Temperament appears to be fairly largely biological.
So how does cognitive affect it?
How does cognitive development relate to it? Good question. I don't know. I'm sorry? Yeah, that would be more psychosocial. I'm having difficulty with the cognitive connection to temperament. But clearly people do discover they don't like themselves or how they use their temperament. Well, I can make an example there, particularly in adolescence, because in adolescence, as you become formal operational, one of the issues is how well does your behavior hang together, and sometimes people discover that they're not happy with the kind of temperament they have, the kind of personality that they're developing, and they project that into the future or begin to see that it's affecting their ability to have the kinds of relationships that they want, and the cognitive skills are permitting them to see how harmful or dissatisfying the temperament is, and that might then kick off attempts at self-improvement. The reflective skills of adolescence would be letting you understand the issue of temperament.
So, would temperament change, or just your ability to control how you react from?
The question is whether then do you change your temperament, or do you change your expression of it? And the text describes, I think, at least one situation, maybe two, in which their claim is that temperament changed. My sense is that we don't really change our temperament, but we change its expression. But we work on managing our responses. And I'll give you an example of that from watching a person in his 20s who was concerned about intimacy and being able to find a partner, and his temperament would have been described as slow to warm up. And what he was discovering was that he was being very slow to warm up in interpersonal relationships, particularly in dating relationships, and he was being left in the dust. And people, the women he was trying to court over time, he realized they just kept saying, you know, you're really dull, you don't seem to be interested, I'm moving on. And when he put that together, he realized that his temperament was depriving him of the relationships that he wanted. It wasn't that he wasn't interested, he just took a long time to be able to express that. So he went through some very specific efforts to be more interesting and be more expressive of his potential interest, while also explaining that he was pretty slow to warm up in all kinds of situations. And over a couple of years, he made some significant progress in that. And the last time I talked with him, was in a relationship that had grown slowly, but he found somebody who understood that and was willing to let him take time to warm up in the relationship. So it was a matter of him discovering that he could understand the problem and he was the only one who could do something about it. But it didn't make him less slow to warm up. It didn't change his temperament. He's still slow to warm up, but he was able to manage it better and not let it end the relationships before they warmed up. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you should be able to. There are only three, so you ought to be able to give at least a brief description or use them, recognize when somebody is difficult or easy, or know what those characteristics are. And then I also talked about shyness from Kagan's research, which is related but different, so you also might want to look over that, what Kagan and his colleagues found about the transaction between parents and children who were potentially going to be shy and fearful, and the importance of the parental transaction. It goes back to this piece. No, Montessori was just, I just wanted you to understand where Erickson got one of his basic principles. But Montessori, I won't ask a question about. Do you need to know about gender schema theory? Or would I go over it? Either one. Oh, geez, where does gender come from? I'm not going to go out on that limb right now and try to describe gender schema theory. Not going to do that. And you can interpret that however you want. Bowlby's phases of attachment. You probably ought to have a sense of how attachment progresses from his perspective. It's fairly straightforward, indiscriminate to specific. Think about indiscriminate as a kind of undifferentiated, and then specific as meaning you've separated some relationships out from the rest. And then what would integration be in that case? It would be being able to have more than one specific attachment so that you can make the transition from childcare to home and back and have attachments, secure attachments in both places. Before dying. No, I guess I would review that stuff, what happens as people are approaching death, if they know they are, what are they facing? You tired? Your head's full? You need to go sort them out and have a good dinner? Okay, do that. You're welcome.